Good morning.
Good morning.
One thing I noticed with your songbook is that the authors of the songs are written above them, which is quite useful. And not only the authors, but their birth date and death date is written there. You know, we know our birth date and we're waiting to find out the next one. But for example, that song, "We Rest in Thee, on Thee, Our Shield and Our Defender." It's a great encouragement, that song, especially with the nice music from Finlandia to it. How old do you think the author was of that hymn? Look at it in your chorus books. These are little hints. It's number 735. 735. She was born in 1872. It's a bit before Brother John. 1872. Died in 1897. What does that make? She lived 25 years. And she made a contribution to Christianity. To a Christian. Sometimes we have this idea that you have to wait for a certain age or certain thing before we can start making contributions to the body of Christ. Look. It's a sister. Less than 25. It's an encouragement for each one of us not to keep on waiting for something big in the future. Someone told me that Darby finished his synopsis before he was 30. The Brethren movement of the early 1800s was mainly powered by brothers between the 20 and the 30 years of age. Now we have this idea that brethren have to do with old people. It was people, young people, in their 20s to 30s, who felt called, who felt they really wanted to, discover things in Scripture, who really got in there, and God used them in some way. It's an encouragement. There's nothing virtuous in being young, but there's nothing against being young. The doors are open for God to use. There's another hymn I want to just draw your attention to before we turn to Scriptures, and that was 757. "When peace like a river attendeth my way." Now here's someone who died at 60 before he wrote this one, so he probably died somewhat young. 60 years, perhaps relatively young, we would say. But what I want to draw your attention here is to interpretation. He quotes Jordan in his song. Do you notice the River Jordan is quoted in his song? That's in verse 4. "If Jordan above me shall roll, no pang shall be mine, for in death as in life, you will whisper your peace to my soul." What's he equating Jordan with in that song? A death. So, he is using a kind of a very macro view of the Old Testament story. One where you would say that Egypt represents before conversion. You leave Egypt, maybe you could say the Red Sea represents your conversion. Then you have 40 years in the wilderness, which represents your life here on earth. Then you have Jordan, which represents your death. And then you reach the Promised Land. You see that, how they're interpreting it? That's okay, as long as you don't go into too many details. Because then you start thinking, oh, in the heaven we have to fight and conquer and all these other kind of things and then you've gone too far. On that global level, the picture of the Old Testament fits what we see in the New. What we're doing in this weekend is that we're looking at the Promised Land, the last bit, and we realize there's fighting going on, there's a promise to possess, there's a gift to be claimed, and we are involved in that fight. So in that respect, it's dealing with our life on earth. Does that make sense? Yeah? It just shows that there's different ways of looking at passages in the Old Testament. There's not a unique way, and they're valid, but we have to be careful because the truth cannot be derived from pictures. We cannot take, for example, this idea that Jordan is death, and therefore in the Promised Land, in heaven, we're still fighting. Well, that's gone too far. If you want to prove that we fight in heaven, you have to find some other New Testament or clear scriptures to prove that. And clearly it's not there. It's a time of rest and other things. I remember a few years ago, listening to a speech by John Major. I'd listened to part of it. I quite like John Major, and I'm not going to get into politics here, but he was quite a clever man. Maybe because he was brought up in a circus. I don't know what caused that, but he makes very interesting speeches. And his speech was a speech to Parliament just before the invasion of Iraq. So you can place yourself. So they're debating in Parliament whether yes or no to invade Iraq a few years ago. Now, what I find interesting about his argument was that he said, to knock Saddam Hussein off and to take, to invade is no problem. We can do that within a couple of days or weeks. The big problem is what do you do next? Because the country is full of different, two types of Muslims who hate each other, tribal differences. The big problem is how do we put that country on its feet after we've invaded? And I can't see any easy way of doing that, so I'd recommend don't invade. Now, I won't say whether I agree with them or not on the political side. We can discuss that over coffee later on or something. But what I thought was interesting, that he was looking at the long term. He was looking at the future and trying to see how can we prepare for the long term future. We've had that just recently, if you've noticed the news, with Libya. From one moment to the next, there was a hype all around the world. We have to bomb Libya. We have to bomb, bomb, bomb. And the French, the Americans are a bit hesitant. And, we'll lend you some boats, but we want to get involved. And within a couple of, 1 or 2 weeks, we were bombing it. With no strategy what we're going to do in the long term. Yeah, now Gaddafi is nearly caught or can't find. I don't know. I haven't listened to the news the last few days. What's going to happen next? In the Christian life, too. We have a future, and we need to plan now to take care of the future. Joshua was busy, and we saw that in the first 12 chapters of Joshua. He's busy fighting and fighting and fighting, but when you finish fighting, what do? And then we come to the second set of 12 chapters, 13 to 24. Okay, we've conquered a lot of the land, now what? If you like kind of mental handles to get hold of a book, and I'd recommend that strategy, the first 12 chapters can be easily divided in two parts. The first 5 chapters is preparing to fight, and then in chapter 6 they go into Jericho and stuff. So 6 to 12, the other 7 chapters is fighting to take over the land. Then we come to the second part, the possession of the land. And then there we have the first 9 chapters of the second part deal with distributing the land and the cities. Now, you take this, I take this, and you're throwing some holy dice and trying to sort it all out so that everyone takes their share. And the last 3 chapters on, how are we going to live together in this new land? Distribution, and how are we going to live together? So what I'd like to address this morning is 5 lessons we can learn from Joshua in the way he prepared the people to live in the new land, preparing for that new future. Now, the first thing I observe is that both the Lord and Joshua were concerned about the next generation. They were not concerned only about us and me getting into a land, and I need rest, and I hate slavery, and I want to have a farm, and I want to have a vineyard. They're also considering those who are going to follow us. If you'd like to open your Bible, we'll look at some of these things. I noticed that they do this in 3 different ways. In Joshua chapter 4, Verse 20, and Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. So they've been carrying these whacking stones for quite a journey to put them in, set them up. He said to the Israelites, "In the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them Israel crossed the Jordan on the dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea, when he dried it up before until we had all crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and that you might always fear the Lord your God. So the first way I notice that they're preparing the next generation is through symbols. They set up these big 12 rocks, and I'm sure every time you're going to play football in the neighborhood or you're walking past, say, "Hey, Dad, what are these big rocks doing here?" And they gave a chance to say, "Hey, but that's a reminder of something that happened 20, 40, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when the Lord opened. But if you look at chapter 4, verse 6, they serve these stones, serve among you in the future when your children ask you, when your children, this is a focus on the kids, the children, which would be following. In chapter 5, Frederick mentioned this yesterday, I'll just explain it, I'll just mention it. In chapter 5, verse 10, on the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped in Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the... What's the Passover? Another symbol. The stones were a static symbol. And here's a nice meal together. They're eating it with herbs and a bit of a barbecue setting. You can't sit down on this one. You're eating it standing up. I can imagine the kids get quite excited that we're having this something special kind of meal. It's a symbolic something. In chapter 5, a bit further up, I think it's verse 2. And at that time the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites." Again. What's that? Also a symbol. Quite a private one, but it's also a symbol. Yes, every time you go, you remember, you see something, you're aware that you've been marked, that you're different. It's symbols. So one way I notice that God uses to teach us things and encourages the Jewish nation to teach their descendants, because the Lord is interested not only in us, but also our children and grandchildren and those who might follow, until Christ comes, of course, is through symbols. I ask myself, okay, what kind of symbols can we use? What can we use of this strategy of teaching in our current day today? Now you say, "Oh, well, of course, baptism is a good symbol." That's true. You know, every time we have a baptism service, children watch it and say, "When are you going to be baptized?" Our son Edward was baptized last year. Our daughter Julie, she's 14, she's not baptized. We were giving her time, letting... It's when she sees a baptism, and we have one in the end of September, we've got one in our assembly. You see it, and it's a symbolic act, useful for the person themselves, because they have to define, shall I be baptized or not? What? And then a spiritual struggle goes inside. It helps them decide. But also those who see it. Hey, what's that? A chance to teach something. Are there any other symbols you can think of we can use today as part of this passing on to the next generation? Oh, the breaking of bread. Now, yes, that is also a symbol. My encouragement is to try to be a bit more think out of the box. I noticed quite a few young people have a little wristband. It says WWJD. You know what that stands for? Not WC. It's JD. What would Jesus do? Now, someone came up with that symbolic idea to encourage young people to have a cool little looking little bracelet, and to think, when you're going to do something, would Jesus do this? Some of the young people went to a music festival from our assembly in the summer, and they came back with a green, our Edward went there, and they came back with a green thing. Something about holiness. Again, it's symbolic. Okay, it shows that you're a member of the, that you paid your entrance fee and stuff. But the message on it was to encourage them through some symbolism to carry on something scriptural. We have other symbols. We've got this little, those who get married. You don't have to have a ring. But just in case you begin to have a tendency or a desire to flirt with someone, then you think, oh, wait a minute, I'm a married man or married woman. That doesn't go with me. With our elders' daughters, Vicky and Elsa, when they were 15, we had a chat with them about purity and keeping themselves virgin and clean until marriage. So we wrote up a little promise to the Lord that I will, you know, look after my body and not be a temptation to men and try to keep myself pure for marriage. And we said to them, if you agree with this and you'd like to, if you sign it, we will frame it so you can have it in your bedroom. And one or two days later, they brought it back to us signed, so we framed it and we gave them a little ring to wear in connection with that promise. With Edward, you know, when he was 15, we thought, well, you know, little rings with boys doesn't really go. But we thought the same idea. We would like him to, you know, so the same little, it's symbolic. With him, I think we bought a watch or something. You know, just something so that you associate that symbol with that promise. And okay, our eldest daughter got married 4 weeks ago, and she took her thing. I noticed her bedroom, that the thing that's always been hanging in the bedroom was gone, so she took it with her. She told us that on the wedding day, she took that ring off and gave it to Stephen. Little symbolisms. But through this little symbolism, we see them in the Old Testament, that we can pass on information, pass on good things to the following generation. It says, when your children ask, then you can explain. The symbol itself, without an explanation, becomes useless in time. There needs to be an explanation with a symbolic act. Now, I think in many assemblies, it's quite a custom to, when someone's going to be received into fellowship, he's announced one Sunday, they say, next Sunday, brother, sister, and so-and-so will start breaking bread with us. When I arrived in our assembly in Holland, that was also the custom. I notice now they don't do that anymore. So just recently, for example, on a Sunday morning, at the beginning of the breaking of bread, someone said, oh, young man, so-and-so, as from today, he will be breaking bread with us, and we're very glad and welcome on the Lord's table. And then the meeting went okay. Now, that's usually okay, but this happens that the last time it happened, the testimony of the young man in question was in question. So a number of people in the assembly thought, hey, but, you know, I can't see evidences of holy life in him. You know, he's a, you know, so it caused unrest. So last week we talked it over with a few brothers. Said, yeah, we've always been doing that tradition. That's why we stopped, because we're cutting out traditions. I said, yes, okay, it could be. The thing is that it has been done for many years without explanations. So it becomes just a dry tradition to announce him one Sunday, to receive him the next one. If you say that we as an assembly receive someone new, then it's good to announce him a week before. That's one way of doing it. So that if anyone in the assembly, their conscience is unrestful about this, they have a time to phone, to ask, you know, have they looked into this? Is it been? And then the following Sunday, they're at peace. Now, if you explain the reason for things, then on the whole, oh, okay, if that's the reason, I can see the value of the symbol or symbolic act. But without explanation, symbols become dry, mechanical. In fact, they become a hindrance to the normal Christian life. In chapter 8, verse 34, in Joshua 8, 34, afterwards, Joshua read all the words of the law. So he didn't rely just on symbols. He didn't wait passively for the children to ask only. He also was proactive. He also decided to read all the words of the blessing and the curses, just as written in the book of the law. 35. There was not a word in all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including, just in case we didn't understand, including women, children, and the aliens who lived among them. So another way to pass on to the next generation is through explaining, reading, teaching God's word. Now, in our assembly, once a month, we have a youth service. I'm not too sure. I have my doubts about some things, but it's good to... It's because the young people seem to get bored in the meeting, so we have a special meeting for them parallel with the morning meeting. Okay, maybe it has some good values to it too. The danger is that we need to find ways of doing assembly life, doing church, doing community, in a way that children, mums, dads, everyone is together on this. The modern trend is to have youth workers and youth pastors with the youth, and then the rest here. And then you kind of get two things growing at the same time. Here they manage, for example, to have a reading. You had the mums, you had the children, and the aliens. Perhaps it could represent new believers, all learning together. Now, it is a great danger for us men to think that in quite a few Bible conferences and things, usually you get many more men coming along to discuss things than the wives. They stay often at home with the children. Now, sometimes it's practical, it's difficult too. But what I'd like to draw attention on here is that the wives, the women, and the children also need to hear the word. In fact, if we're thinking about the next generation, if you're thinking about your children in the future, mums have a greater influence over the future of children than do dads. So if we men are very concerned about our being in the Bible reading and our being in the prayer meeting, the wife can just stay up here, I'll just tell you roughly what it was about, then if the wife's spiritual life begins to cool off, what's she going to pass on to the kids? Do you see what I'm saying? Those of us who are married, it's imperative to be concerned about the spiritual temperature of our wives. And this is, we see it here also. So, to pass on to the next generation, we see there are symbols, and we could try to think of symbols and we could try to use in our families, in our assembly, or in our... There are words, we need to use the word of God too. And the third way they pass on this good thing to the next generation is through role models. Let's look at one, for example, in chapter 14. So, Joshua chapter 14, is anybody 80 years old here? 80 years old? Okay, here's a story about an 80-year-old. In fact, a bit more than 80, 85. Chapter 14 and verse 7. This is Caleb speaking. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. He's one of the 12 spies. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. Verse 8. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people sink. I, Caleb, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. 9. So, verse 10, sorry, just jump a bit for time. Verse 10. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses, while Israel moved into the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out and battle now as I was then. Now, give me this hill country that the Lord has promised me that day. You yourself heard that the Anakites were there in their cities, were large and fortified, but the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. Can you imagine the influence of this kind of old person among the people of God? An old man of 85, feeling as strong as when he was 40. I mean, the Lord must have done something there, some special steroids, spiritual steroids or something, I'm not too sure what, but there he was, an old man, but all fired up still. He wasn't bemoaning and criticizing all the laxity and why haven't you really done things. And I want my peace. I've been hanging around long enough. And good examples inspire God's people. We see this with Caleb in chapter 23, I think it is. We see it with Joshua, where he says, you know, if you don't think it's worthwhile following the Lord, you know, you can choose whether you want the old idols or the new gods or the old gods, but as far as I'm concerned, me and my family, he's providing a model, a role. If we are to inspire and motivate those who are following us, our children, grandchildren, that kind of the next generation, symbols, words, and a good role model. The way we live our Christian life. And of course, I think in the passing from years, we see and hear a lot. And it's easy to start speaking badly of the present and highlighting the virtue of the past. The problem with talking about the virtue of the past and criticizing the present is that it doesn't give any hope for the next generation. When we started going to Cheam Road Hall in London, my wife and I were just married. And then, you know, there's a sister there said, oh, when I was younger, when we came here just married too, we had to come here early on Sundays to make sure we got a seat. And the only feeling I had, oh dear, I was born 50 years too late then. Not my fault, I was just born too late. And it doesn't inspire, it just makes you feel, well, what can I do then? You know, but people like Caleb and Joshua inspire. May the Lord help us be that way. If you'd like to go to your book of Joshua, let's turn a bit further on to chapter 20. There are lots of fun things we could read in the other chapters of how they distribute the land. They were taking possession of the land, but then after a while they got tired and they kind of settled a bit, and they stopped their job. And in the chapters 13 to 19, Joshua's encouraging them to, you know, press on, man. We divide the land up. And look, you take here, we've conquered half of that land. You go and conquer what's left. That's yours. It's yours to take up. If you want that mountain, catch it. Get it. Capture it. Fight for it. And they distributed the land. And then here in chapter 20, we have a short chapter which is titled Cities of Refuge. Let's just read a few verses there, verses 1, 2, and 3. Chapter 20, verses 1. Then the Lord said to Joshua, tell the Israelites to designate the cities of refuge, as I instructed you through Moses, so that anyone who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. Verse 9. Any of the Israelites or any alien living among them who kills someone accidentally could flee to these designated cities and not be killed by the avenger of blood prior to standing trial before the assembly. Now, if you read commentaries, most of the commentaries say, well, cities of refuge, picture of Jesus. You need to come to Jesus and then you find... good. It is a valid application. I'd like to give you a different angle. When I read this, I think, isn't our God realistic? He's aware that accidents can happen. Among some Christians you hear, you think, well, if you're following the Lord wholeheartedly, if you're doing your best, you know, you can't really get sick very much, really. You can't really have a car accident. You know, you're following Jesus. You know, you're a child of God. And accidents can't happen. Well, what I see, the whole essence of having cities of refuge is because accidents can happen. Unintentionally, someone can chop someone's head off. Now, sometimes, just because he didn't put the axe head on properly, like the colleague of Elijah, or things, you know, maybe a bit silly, but you're not always going to chop people's heads off. It can happen accidentally. And God knows that that can happen. And not only can accidents happen, there's something more that can happen. Is that he knows the human heart, that if someone by accident runs over your son or your daughter but in a car, you feel extremely angry with the driver. And maybe it was the child's fault, but you're inclined to kick the driver in. You're inclined, in the spur of the moment, to do irrational things. God knows our human nature, that we humans can do crazy things. Even Christians can do crazy things. So rather than just saying, no, this can't happen, or no, let's pray that this would never happen, he says, no, this might happen, the humans are that way, so we'll set up 6 cities of refuge. 3 on one side of the Jordan, and 3 on the other side of the Jordan. He said the roads to the city of refuge have to be kept open, you know, big highways, so people, if an accident, you can get on the, you know, get on your bike and just cycle as fast as possible. Actually, people were hanging around on the way to help you find the city of refuge, to avoid injustices. Now, what can we learn about that as we look into the future? I think as Christians, we can be optimistic, but I think we can also, or should be, very realistic as we look into the future. Rather than denying the possibility of things going wrong, we need to prepare, preempt. Is it possible that the leadership in an assembly or local church can manipulate a congregation? Is that possible? People who love Jesus, could they do that? Knowing that, we find the New Testament model of plural leadership in a local church. No church with one leader, all of a number of brothers. Now, that doesn't eliminate the problem. It reduces the risk, because if you have a number of brothers together, when one becomes a bit too controlling, the other ones calm him down. You see what I mean? John says, children, I write to you that you will not sin. That's the ideal, don't sin. But if anybody sins, we have one who speaks to the Father in our defense, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. You see what I mean? There's a realism there. Now, the goal is don't sin, but if we do, we have an advocate in 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. Do you think Christians can criticize their leaders? Do you think it's possible for some brother or sister to invent a lie to bring down a Christian leader? Do you think that could happen? Well, you hope it never happened. The fact is that it can happen. And then to prevent or to reduce the risk of this injustice, we read in Timothy 5, do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it's brought by 2 or 3 witnesses. It's just a realistic message to minimize injustice. Sometimes they say, well, this sister is so correct, they can manage the accounts of the assembly on their own. Oh, she can count it on, oh, she's very trustworthy. She can do it. It's not that they're not trustworthy, it's that you need to protect, because we are human. It's much better always to count monies in 2s. It's always best to have the account of the assembly in 2s or 3s or something like that. When we read in Acts that when people were selling their houses, they brought the money, not to Peter, but they put it at the feet of the, with an S at the end, apostles. You know, they together decided. Why? It keeps transparency. If you manage the monies on your own, and then someone thinks, oh, Tim's got new shoes today, I bet he's putting his hand in there somewhere. How can he defend himself? It's his word against another person's word. So that's why the managing of finances. I was in Congo about 2 or 3 years ago. And I went to one of the assemblies in Kinshasa where we had our meeting. We were invited to the meeting in the afternoon, at 2 in the afternoon. Because in the morning, the assembly had split. In the morning, a group had a meeting. And in the afternoon, the other one. And they were fighting over the building, who could keep the building. But fighting is too strong, but it's pretty close too. Now, you think, when you're starting an assembly, how on earth could this happen, that people of God who are worshipping, how would they kind of start making issues about bricks and stuff like that? Does it happen? It can happen. What I learned from the cities of refuge is that when we set things up, we need to set them up in a proper and clear way, if we're thinking about the future, to preempt injustices. Do the paperwork nice and properly. Put nice trustees in there. Have all the rules and set up. Before any problems, have it nicely set up. Like the cities of refuge, no one hopes for accidents, But they will happen, and our vengeances and carnal behavior will happen, so let's do as much as possible to prepare. So it's very practical. I don't know how you set up your trustees or your meeting room or how you run your gifts or all these kind of things, but the cities of refuge teach us to be careful as we look at the future in these things. But not only in financial things. Is it possible that in a Christian family we start watching films which we should not watch? Is it possible in Christian families to start downloading or looking at pornography? Now, this can happen to me, it can happen to you. So if we can find ways of preempting that, maybe putting a filter on your computer, maybe, like many, have their internet connection in the living room, so it gets a bit more public, so you work and you're not in the living room, rather than having them all in the bedrooms or something like that. In Colombia, people are very conservative on what you do with the opposite sex. I'm not saying that bad things don't happen, but they view it very dimly if you as a Christian travel some distance with a sister in your car. In Holland, it's just no issue, you're just taking her, that's it, right? But there if you're going to take a sister from one city to another, maybe an hour's drive or something, you say, I'll take you with your son, I'll take you with your daughter, I'll take you with your mother-in-law, I'll never take you alone. I remember reading an American book written by... He wrote it because he saw so many Christian leaders had moral failures with their secretaries, with another sister in ministry, all these sexual scandals. And he wrote this book, I read it in Spanish, it was called Vallas Protectoras, Protecting Fences. So he lists a number of things he set, not to be legalistic, but he set those fences for himself to protect him from getting closer to areas. If you know that here's the edge, here's sin and here's not sin, many Christians like to play all until the edge. I haven't fallen off yet. I'm still, but then you get very close and you can easily slip. So it's best to make a fence maybe 1 meter in. You see, so if you get to the fence, yes, you could step over the fence and you're still not sinning, but you're much closer to it. So you might stay on the side of the fence. So for example, he was in his list of things, I remember a few, he would never travel alone with a woman, or if it really had to be, flying alone, he would phone his wife when he took off, he would phone his wife when he took... He would really make it really obvious that he was in contact with his wife during that time. He made a point never to eat alone with a woman. Even if he was in business, three, four, but never, because when you're eating and chatting, something intimate begins to happen there. Just to play it safe, if I'm just alone with you, I'll just go off and get him a hamburger or something. So he had a number of what you would call legalistic kind of things. But he said, I don't apply them to anybody else, just to myself. God is realistic about our weakness, useful for us to be the same and protect ourselves. Now, let's move on a bit to chapter 21. And here we find another interesting bit. Towns for the Levites. Chapter 21, verse 1. Now, the family heads of the Levites approached Eleazar, the priest, Joshua, the son of Nun, and the heads of the other tribal families of Israel at Silo in Canaan, and said to them, verse 2, the Lord commanded through Moses that you give us towns to live in, with pastures for our livestock. There was 12 tribes of Israel. One of the tribes, Levi, was not given any land, but only cities. They were given 48 cities. On average, every tribe gave 4. On average, because some of them gave more. 44. Of those 48 cities they got, 6 of those 48 were the refuge, cities of refuge. They were not given land. They were given enough land for their cattle. That's equivalent to having fridges and stuff to keep their food, rather than killing animals, you have them grassing until you need them. Now, you know that, don't you? Perhaps my question is, why did Israel need Levites? Were they really necessary? Was that a parasitic tribe living, sponging of the other hard-working tribes. Well, fortunately, it was not their idea. It was God himself who designed this kind of thing. And he had one tribe, one in the 12, devoted to special activities. He had them devoted to running the temple and getting the animals for sacrifices organized and all that. The fact that six of the 48 cities, the refuge ones, were theirs, so one of their jobs was to run the cities of refuge. And when people come running in, you know, or panicky, well, look, come in, tell us your story. Does it make sense? If it makes sense, you can stay with us. If it doesn't make sense, you're out, you know. So they had a bit of a judgment to kind of how to organize this. So they had a function within Israel. Now, a more difficult question. What does this teach us for us today as Christians? The existence of the Levites. Now, here we come with differences. Some would say, no, it's natural, you see. The other tribes represent the laity, and the Levites represent the priesthood. The priests, you know, that's why we have ordained priests and so on. So then they run the church. They're the ones that marry, they're the ones that baptize, they're the ones that preach, they're the Levite. You can see how easily we take over that idea from the Old Testament. But we do know from the New Testament that we are a nation of priests. That, as opposed to the Old Testament, where it's, you know, one tribe, we all can bring worship and offerings to the Lord. Okay. So that's not a very good application. What's a good application then? I thought, well, here's some ideas. In assembly circles, 200 years ago, with the movement of the Bremer movement, we reacted strongly against this clerical idea, right? The clergy and what's that, and the rest. And we saw, no, that's not a biblical model. But usually when we react against things, sometimes, or usually we can, quite often, we go to another extreme. We go too far. And the idea that every brother and sister is equal. And that's not true. That denies the fact that God gives, the Spirit gives gifts. In Romans, 1 Corinthians 12, that yes, we're equal in value. Yes, we can all bring worship. Yes, we're all priests. But no, we're not all identical. That some have been given gifts. And the gifts are to be used and to be recognized as such. Sometimes in assembly, where there's four brothers in the assembly, and they take basically turns preaching. You think, well, if all four have the same gift, that makes sense. But if two of the four really have a gift of teaching, they should be doing more of the teaching than the rest, because that's their gift. It's to function, and I think that's one of our weaknesses, and we can recapture and reorganize, is that to recognize when someone has certain gift, God has given that for the benefit of the assembly, of the church, of the churches, allow them and encourage them to use that gift. It's not a matter of doing everything in turns. If someone is more musically gifted, someone's more counseling gifted, someone's more helps gifted, all those different gifts, they should be exercised them more. Just imagine if your feet, the image of the body with different parts, just imagine if the feet got tired of carrying the body around. So now we're always carrying this body around. I think it's time for maybe the elbows, or maybe the hands could do it for a while. And you think it's not, you know? Now, if you try, you can walk on your hands. Very uncomfortable. It won't go too well. Because God designed that part of the body to do that function. So if God has given you particularly a leadership gift, for example, you think, well, I've been leading this for a while, it's turned for someone else. Well, if there are others with the gift of leadership, fine. But if you're the one, or you are the few with it, keep on doing it. That's your gift. That's your place in the body of Christ. So when I think of the Levites and having them special place, I think perhaps we can learn that we should recognize the special giftedness God gives different brothers and sisters. But perhaps there's another lesson. What I noticed that the Levites, to be able to survive, they had some fields, so they could do a bit, you know, have their cows and sheep and so on. But they had no big land to plow, so they depended on someone. And who did they depend? On the Lord, obviously. And the Lord said, the other 11 tribes should give. So if the other tribes give 10% of their income, then they get 110% in total. And then the Levites also had to give 10% of their income for Aaron. So then roughly it was all roughly balanced. Now what I noticed from what I gather from our 200-year history of brethren, we are happy to recognize on the whole evangelists. We're happy to recognize missionaries, because they take off and disappear, right? And if there is a gifted person and teaching that in it, then we don't want them to settle. You have to keep on moving. Because he might become too powerful. He might become the vicar if he stays in his home assembly. So we want him to keep on moving with his gift and going around and don't develop anything locally. The fear that if there is a full-time worker associated with an assembly, then people will think, oh, he's the pastor. We don't want that to happen. So no, brother, you just keep on moving and then we'll support you. A bit weird. If you read a bit of statistics about things, you need to look at statistics. The difference is that when someone is full-time or part-time or is released 1 or 2 days from his work to be able to involve in the thing, he's not more important than other brothers and sisters in his local assembly. The only difference between part-time and full-time or whatever is that he has more energy and time available to do things. And yes, in the beginning of the Brethren movement, there were quite a few quite wealthy families that could afford to just devote their time to write books and do teachings and all sorts of things, and they had enough monies in their bank accounts to keep themselves going. But when that generation died off and the money kind of ran out, or I don't know what happened to it, then I think sometimes we've lost that ability to sponsor people locally for local things. So we're all dependent on pensioned or people who've got a family and their job and they're trying to fit in a bit of speed moment here. No surprise that the brethren had a reputation of high Bible knowledge, lots of Bible knowledge, and today you can't really see too much of that around. We have lots of books, old books. But to develop Bible knowledge and to keep it alive, you need time, you need energy, you need devotion. Good Bible studies don't come up just by 4 or 5 hours hard work. You need to devote days to things to grab them. So perhaps here is just before we move on, as we look into the future, because that's the idea of this today, is there anything we can change in our assembly, our perception of allowing gifted brothers and sisters to devote more time to what they're good at? Chapter 17, I'd like to point something else out here. Chapter 17, verse 12. Yet the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Now, for time, I'm not going to read all the passages, but you can find this comes 4 or 5 or 6 times in Joshua. That they fought, and then they got tired and left some people living there. And then later on had another try, and sometimes, these Canaanites really like to stay here, so let's just let them stay. In fact, when you look at it carefully, the Israelites never cleared up the complete land. There were always people living among them. Not only the Gibeonites where they agreed to, but all the ones that they didn't want to, but they're quite strong, they got horses, they got chariots, so let's just let them be. Now, here I see as we look into, when we look into the future of the Israelites, we realize that these pockets of resistance which stayed within the borders, the boundaries of Israel, caused them many problems in the future. Because you have enemies living inside the land. So when people were to attack from outside, they can rely on help from inside. When their daughters were looking for husbands or sons looking for daughters, there was a temptation there. You see their barn dances and things, and you just go with your binoculars and have a look, and you go, oh, they've got something good there. Ooh. The temptation is easier. And it happened. Now, what spiritual lessons can we find from that as we look to our future? Now one, I think obvious one, clear one, I think, is that in our Christian life, in your life, in my life, we can leave unfinished tasks inside. The Lord begins to work in us, and we begin to clean something up, we begin to conquer something. And after a while, we got a bit tired, and we become satisfied with partial victory. We become content with, we're not quite there, but it's good enough. Let's just settle for this. Yes? We come back from a conference or some book we've read or some film and think, yeah, holiness, the Lord does want me. So, I organize, as prophetic we mentioned yesterday, I go through all my my CDs, you know, my music stuff, and I've been a part of the my music stuff. But and then my MP3 player and my video collection, well, I leave that then. I made an effort. We don't take it fully. You know, we just, for a while, and this is human nature, that's what they did, and it was so easy for us also to do it. We become complacent, happy, satisfied with partial victory. Complete perfection awaits us in heaven. And down here on earth, we always have this conflict area. But what I would like to encourage us is not to relax. To say, well, I've still got some enemy territory, some areas I haven't really handed over to the Lord. To say, well, but I think it's good enough like that. Let's just leave it. The Lord wants us to carry on. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal bodies so that you obey its evil desires. We have fights from within. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, stand firm. We have problems from outside. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, powers, dark world, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on your full armor. There's a demonic battle taking place. So perhaps a lesson from these people taking possession of the promised land is that, yeah, we also are in this kind of fighting stage. Let's not forget it. The peace, the relaxation, the full rest comes future. Around here we need to be alert and constant aware of this. The last point I'd like to share with you about preparing for the future has to do with a little funny thing. It happens in chapter 22. You know that with Moses, the Israelites came up through the right-hand side of the River Jordan, as we pointed out yesterday. And then before they crossed the Jordan, Moses died. And 2.5 tribes had their land on the right-hand side of the Jordan. And they were happy to settle down and let the other tribes invade the rest. And Moses said to them, no, you can't settle down yet. Leave your wives and children here with some people to look after them. And the fighting men, go over the Jordan, join your brothers and fight for them until, you know, help them. And when it's all ready, then you come back and take possession of your land. You need to stay together fighting until it's... So that's what happened. After the land was distributed, the 2.5 tribes said, okay, good luck, chaps. High five. We're heading back now. And they, Joshua had a little speech, a pep speech. It's a good start, thank you very much, and see you, folk. And they took off. And then this thing happens. 22 verse 10. When they came to Gilead, this is the 2.5 tribes, the fighting men, near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, those are the 2.5 tribes, built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built an altar on the border of Canaan at Gilead, near Jordan, on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered in Shiloh to go to war against them. 16. The whole assembly of the Lord says, how could you break faith with God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him? Verse 18. And are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. It's an interesting little thing, because now they've conquered the land, they've distributed the land, and now the question is, how are we going to live together? These 2.5 tribes head back, and just before they cross the river, they build an imposing big altar. The other tribes jump to a conclusion. They judge the 2.5 tribes. They judge, what did they judge? They judge the motives. Now, I find this an interesting part, because we as a brethren movement are experts in judging. You know, we're very good at judging all the other Christian groups, and we're very good at judging each other too. And it's easy to be embattled, criticizing and judging them around and inside. When you read about judging, you find there are some scriptures that say, don't judge or you will be judged. And other scriptures that say, judge. So you come across that tension that some say, don't, and others say, do. And then you think, well, I like judging, so I'll just do it. You know, or when do I not? Should a Christian judge another Christian? Last year I was involved, until January this year, writing a paper on the homosexual partnership, a Christian position on the homosexual partnership. And in the chats I had, and the research and so on, I was doing kind of get together, and now people say, well, why do you want to judge? It's not your thing. No, if you're straight and you've got a wife, that's you. Well, why do you want to judge? If God's made them that way, let them express the way they are. And you know, all this kind of, who are you to judge them? It's not your business. I realize that judging is a management tool. It's a biblical management tool. And if you're in responsibility, you're required to judge. But it's not an open-ended kind of thing. It has its borders. I'll give you an example. Imagine a traffic warden, a Dutch traffic warden. You know, the Dutch like to be quite a bit German in that respect. They love rules and they like to make people respect them. And here we have this Dutch traffic warden. Now, suppose you approach the traffic warden and you say, look, see that man over there? He's fiddling his tax forms. I know, he's fiddling his tax forms. What will the tax warden say? The traffic warden say? He'll say, it's bad, I realize, but I it's nothing to do with me. My job is traffic. That's what I'm in. That's my area of responsibility. So yes, that's wrong. But I don't. It's not my job to judge that kind of thing. I'm out of that. Now, suppose you approach the traffic warden, and you say, the Dutch traffic warden, and you say, the traffic in Paris is horrible. You know, I saw someone there in Paris, and he skipped the traffic light. I jotted down his traffic, his number plate. What would the Dutch traffic warden say? My area is Holland. Yeah, it's bad that he skipped the traffic light. Nothing to do with me. I won't judge. I know my limits. So people with authority require judgment, but there are limits to the area and who does it. And suppose you come to the traffic warden and you say, look, my neighbor, he hates traffic lights. You know that speed limit of 50? He thinks that's wrong. He thinks it should be 70. You know, nick him. What would the traffic warden say? I only deal with actions. If he hates the traffic law, you know, if he doesn't like the, no, if he thinks the roundabout is too small, he can think whatever he do. But when he skips the traffic light, when he runs at 70, when it says 50, then I'm interested. That's my area. So we notice that people with authority require judgment, and they need to exercise that. But even then, the judgment has its limits. Are we required? Does God hold us responsible for judging others? Now here in the book of Joshua, we find two examples which deal a great deal on this theme. And I only have 5 minutes to finish, so I can't really elaborate. But I want to just mention it so you can work on it later on. When you have an interpretation, a typological or some kind of allegorical interpretation, and you think, well, Israel is like the church, and then Achan, one man sinned, and the whole nation was defiled. So therefore, if one brother sins and he breaks bread in my assembly, then the whole assembly is defiled. You know, you take that kind of thing, you think, well, wait a minute. The church is a mystery revealed in the New Testament. The functioning of the church, we find the guidelines in the New Testament, and the Old Testament helps us with pictures to illustrate some of these points. The nation of Israel, and this is standard theology, is not the same as the church. They're God's people, but they're two different, the earthly people and the heavenly people. They're a different kind of thing. So when we want to know what happens with the New Testament, we see examples, for example, in Acts chapter 15, Ananias and Sapphira sinned. God did not judge the whole church. God judged them. In 1 Corinthians 5, there was an immoral brother there. But people were aware of it. The assembly was aware of it and was not acting. Then the assembly becomes responsible. If someone comes to our assembly carrying a sin, we're not defiled, we're not affected until we know and becomes obvious. Then we need to act. Then we need to judge. The second episode is the one we just read. Some would say, well, Israel is a picture of the church. The tribes are pictures of the assemblies. So here we find 2.5 tribes about to do something that's wrong. And the other tribes come in and sort them out. Because, as we said in this verse here, we read, if you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. So we need to sort that out, otherwise the whole Israel. What people, the name people give this in theology is collective responsibility. Are we responsible for what happens in all the other churches? Now if you say, if you have that interpretation using the Old Testament, you can come to that kind of conclusion. And it's caused lots of problems where one assembly is always trying to check out what other assemblies are doing and trying to set them right. The New Testament, we can't find that happening. And there are lots of serious problems in the New Testament. I, for one, would be very hesitant to go to the assembly in Corinth if I live nearby. I'll choose another one. There's a mess in that assembly. Lots of good things, but you know, all these fighting going on and immoral things and all sorts of things. But we don't find one assembly going to sort out the problems of another one. In fact, the clearest example is in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, where we find 7 assemblies, each assembly with its problems, and Christ, who walks between the candlesticks, who walks between the assemblies, he goes to one assembly and says, look, this is good and this is bad, set it right. This is good, next one, this is good, congratulations, this is wrong, set it right. He never tells one assembly, look, that was wrong there. Why didn't you sort that one out? Every assembly was responsible for its actions and was commended for that. Does it mean then that we just, everyone fends for himself, doesn't really matter? No, there's a bond of brotherhood. I have 2 brothers, 2 sisters. Now we get on okay and so on. If my brother Andrew, if I noticed something in the way he was bringing up his children, or the way he was treating his wife, which I thought, well, that's not very good. What would I say? What would I do? Would I say, hey, Andrew, stop it? You know? No, I can't do that. It's his family. He's head of his family. I'm of mine. But because he's my brother and we appreciate each other, I'll find a way to talk with him. That's, I think, the relationship between assemblies. Because we're brothers, because we're sisters, because we're a brotherhood, we're interested in helping each other. Not to say that you can't. No, we stay brothers. But because we love each other, when we notice something seriously wrong, we try to have a word and try to encourage a healthy path. As we look to the future, this kind of thing also has to be clear. blurredness on this part of theology is just a recipe of future problems. When you read a bit of history of the Brethren, I've read a bit, you find that the same kind of software, the same kind of theology causes a division here. 40 years later, it causes the same division again. Different people, a different situation, but the same software. They haven't corrected the software. Do you understand what I mean by software? It's the same kind of interpretation of these texts that causes the same division again. Or another division with the same arguments. So as we look at the future, we need to, I think, spend more time thinking about this and saying, it's not to say we should never judge, it's that there's sometimes we should judge. And there are some situations we know it's wrong, but it's not for us to judge. It's out of our remit. The Lord expects us to be good traffic wardens in Holland, and what we hear comes from, has to do with tax affairs or has some other thing. It is, yeah, I agree with you, but I would not. Because I'm not responsible, the Lord doesn't hold me responsible, and judging is a management tool, I shouldn't. God doesn't want me to go around judging them. He will judge, he will use someone else to do that. Let's just summarize. We've been looking this morning about preparing for a future. And we saw the need to prepare the next generation. Things come from one generation to the next. Perhaps we younger ones, or you younger ones, I don't know where I could place myself there, are we willing to learn from older ones, or do you think we have to kind of invent it all ourselves? It is a generation thing. Some people give the impression that Christianity began 15 years ago. We've got 2,000 years of history. You can learn. Generational thing. An attention to pass it on to parents, this idea of trying to use symbols, trying to kind of think, what kind of symbol can I use? To help bring a, you know, how can I bring some readings in or so? Even in devotionals, yes, you need to. You can't keep on with the same thing. We had a holiday 2 weeks ago, just an example. And then I thought, well, for rather than reading the Bible at the table after the meal every day, I'm going to do something different. I got a series of videos, 20-minute messages. Yeah? By Philip Yancey, but there was a different topic. So I said, after the meal, I said, okay, no Bible reading today, we're going to watch a video. What does that do to the kids, to children? Oh, this is holiday time. This is. So before the washing up, we just sit down and put a video on. Yeah, a 20-minute message, and then we talk a bit about it, and okay, that was it. And just to bring fresh ways of bringing a message. Doesn't mean that we're going to scrap Bible in my house now, there's always videos. No, it's just that 2 weeks of holiday, we did something different. And there were some parents who say, okay, no Bible reading today, we're going to sing. They sit on the piano and they sing two songs. You know, and they maybe comment on one or two of the words of the song. That was it. Just to break the routine. Passing on to the next generation. Secondly, to be realistic. The cities of refuge remind us to be realistic. In our assemblies, in your home, things can go wrong. Let's be realistic and prepare for them. We thought about the Levites. Recognizing gifted people, brothers and sisters, supporting part-time, full-timers, it's not strange, it is healthy. Fourthly, being content with partial victory. If we want a healthy future, we need to continue fighting and clearing things out in our own life. And finally, this issue of judging. If we don't judge when we should judge, we have got a sad future. If we keep on judging but we shouldn't judge, we also have a sad future. May the Lord help us to know when to do which.